Hello, everybody. Here, Gutiman18, your host for today, SmartBCH Twitter Hangout. Okay, today, a guest, special guest is Jet with double T. Okay, Jet Seitche at Autism. Okay, that's his username in Twitter, and he is one of the people responsible for giving every time the BCH podcast, for example. He's the editor there in the program. He's also a programmer, a member of the Bitcoin Cash community. Okay, he has assisted also the BCH conference recently, and he lives in Canada. Okay, everybody, welcome Jet to SmartBCH Twitter Hangout.
Hello, thank you. This is the first Twitter hangout that I was like invited to speak on, so I'm kind of excited.
Yeah, we hope that most people join. Okay, they will start joining. And I am very interested in your lifestyle, for example. I know that you are an anarchist. You make your own food, you grow your food, you eat vegetables, you like Bitcoin Cash, you also like Monero, I think. And I know that you do a lot of non-KYC Bitcoin Cash also. Maybe you have this kind of lifestyle that a lot of people want to know how you do it, okay? Because maybe they are buying in a sex, for example, and they don't have like these kind of scary thoughts about what the government may do in the future if they start making this chain analysis, for example, and all this kind of stuff. So, can you introduce us a little bit about your lifestyle yet?
Sure. So, on the note of growing my own food, while I do, grow some vegetables and herbs and spices and whatnot, that's a very small portion of my diet. I have like four garden beds and a composter and a bit of extra space, but it's not, that is definitely not enough to sustain myself. I think that, Paul Stamets has a fantastic book. I can't remember exactly what it's called right now, but the whole premise of it is like serving self-sustainability for yourself and for your family. And I think that's certainly an admirable goal. That's something that I'd like to work towards. But I live in a city right now, so I grew up on a farm, but I don't have the resources or the time or any of that right now. I'm a developer in my day job. I do like, 9 to 5 kind of style work. And then I mostly just, and this is interesting to say, but I pay, quite a bit of attention to the Bitcoin Cash space just as like a peripheral kind of thing where I'll always have a chat window open and I can see what the general sentiment is. And I say that is kind of weird because there was a probably a couple month period, even while I was producing the podcast for Jeremy, where I really wasn't paying a whole lot of attention to the space. Like, it was the first time in years that I felt like I was burnt out by it. It's been a good experience overall, and I think going to St. Kitts kind of reinforced. I actually know these people. It's not just faces behind a screen for the past 6 years or something like that. As far as like me getting no KYC BCH, that one's a whole can of worms because that didn't always used to be the case, and I can certainly see why it would be incredibly useful for people, or it would have utility, I guess. For people to still use KYC exchanges and whatnot. But it's not just the concern for me of what the government might do in the future. It's knowing that there's a lot of incompetence overall, and I don't really want to deal with the potential consequences of that incompetence. So I try as much as possible while still having some kind of like public voice to keep my involvement with cryptocurrency to a minimum. Like, I appreciate there's some like barter laws or barter standards, I guess, where people using cryptocurrency as a currency, or merchants accepting cryptocurrency as a currency, for a better example, could treat it as a barter transaction where they just pay their taxes like at the market rate. The thing that's used to pay for the item isn't really that big of a concern.
So you're an anarchist? Do you consider yourself anarchist?
Yeah, I don't. It's weird. I think I've definitely been bastardized by the baggage that might have come with that. But I think I identify more with agorist. But I think agorism is more of a practice and less of an ideology. So that's kind of hard to say. So anarchist, but yeah, that sums it up. I'm just being pedantic, maybe.
Okay, and why you started doing this agorism as a lifestyle? When did your brain shift to that ideology, or maybe practice?
I think this goes way back to like being a poor kid. I remember in grade 3 making like twine bracelets and necklaces with friends and like selling those, and eventually the school that we were selling them at shut us down because kids were coming and blowing all their lunch, like school lunch money on our crappy little jewelry. So I think I've always had a little bit of an entrepreneurial flair. But when I had an e-liquid company for vaporizers and e-cigarettes, and dealing with all the paperwork and red tape and taxes, like going from a minimum wage job to owning a company is not something that I think anyone is prepared for. So it was just so much of a headache that I quickly was like, I need a way out.
Okay, so since a kid, you start like working, doing these entrepreneurial things that you said.
Yeah.
And you have been conscious of taxes since then. That's what you are saying, right? yeah, like a consciousness about what taxes are for you. Like they are like taking out part of your gains, right?
Right. I it's weird because I think everyone gets their first paycheck here and they're kind of disgusted and repulsed by the amount of money that gets taken away from taxes, even if you do work a minimum wage job. But then it's not, there's never a compulsion maybe or a real way to act that anger out. So people just go, oh, God damn it. And then they deal with it every other week. And they just do that for 40 years and then retire, and or 60 years now. I don't even think we can hope for a social security or social insurance, anything now.
Yeah, of course. And so then you start researching about agorism. And agorism, I think that it is like separating yourself or your activity from the government, right? That's like the basics of becoming agorist, I think.
So
like
I
being
would say,
doing this self sustenance, right?
Yeah, but I think that that's not necessarily part of agorism. I think agorism can be kind of described more as a strategy against an existing government, and in so much as to say that you cannot have agorism if you live in an anarchist society, so or whatever that might entail, but agorism I think is more of these market divisions working outside of the government for the effect of starving the state or the government, and so without a state or a government, the agorist can't exist.
So you want to starve the government by creating these markets outside of the system?
I don't even, you know, here's the weird thing. I'm not even necessarily against governments, but I think they should be opt-in, not this, like, struggle to fight for your life or opt-out kind of thing. That seems, you know, it's the accident of birth for me to be under the control of these people, and that doesn't make any sense to me at all.
Yeah, because I think that in some countries, for example, the communist countries, they only see their citizens as a kind of productive means, right? Like
right.
Assets in the capitalism systems, and as kind of workers in the communist systems.
Right.
So every time a capitalist invests their assets, they are rewarded in the US, for example. But these assets have to be huge, right? They have to raise a lot of money for them to be able to profit from the system. So little people are like opt out of these systems, and they are by definition, they are being oppressed, like paying taxes, like you said, 30%, and all these kind of paying debts, taxes, credit cards, all these kind of things. And people do not understand money at all. So I think that if, for example, in St. Kitts, Sony has told the committee that they have to start teaching people about Bitcoin Cash, because it's the future of money. So this has not been teach or taught throughout history. Never people have been taught about money or taxes, for example. They are taught how to do work, how to be a good worker, how to pay, start a family, how to be obedient to God, all these kind of things. But they never understand fully the system. So I think that what is happening, for example, in FTX, all these fallouts of crypto, they are from the same guys that are like oppressing the people. They come from the same guys, and that's why they laugh at people. For example, this Bankman-Fried, I think that's how it's pronounced. He is obviously laughing to people. He has been interviewed recently by New York Times, all this stuff. And you can see how he laughs, how he enjoy what he has done. And they reward him, like clapping to him and telling people, look how stupid you are, because you want to opt out of the system using this crypto, all these things. It is only a gamble. So people can start thinking, yeah, it is actually a gamble, crypto and all this stuff. And algorithm, I think it's very related to what the true meaning of Bitcoin Cash, for example, could mean, like start throwing away all these teachings, all these ideologies that we have been taught since our childhoods, and start creating our own systems, like our own kind of organization. And I think it is truly possible if people start like you are doing, I think, this kind of self-grown food and paying each other using something that it is not controlled. So,
well, it's not like it didn't take a long time to work up to, like even getting the kind of career that I'm in, which gives me enough income where I can afford to go to things like the conference and spend time doing the podcast and all these extra things. That took like 3, 4, 5 years of conscious effort. And then there's a lot of, I think, accumulated time where I'm chaotically discovering myself as a teenager, right? I'm trying to... Well, so my handle is autism here for two reasons. One, because I've got Asperger's, and two, because I was an emo kid. So to me, it was kind of funny to be like, autism. So like there were many years where I just, I think almost narcissistically was focused on what the hell am I doing with my life? Unfortunately, it didn't go down this or at least long term, it didn't go down this nihilistic direction. It went to a place where I was like, oh, there's actually an impact that I can make here. And I just need to convince people to care, essentially.
Okay, so you become empathic with other people, and you start introspecting about what were you doing with your life, right?
Right.
And so you discover Bitcoin Cash. how much time did you have been here in the community in Bitcoin Cash?
So Bitcoin Cash, I think, would have came like maybe a month or two after the fork from BTC.
Okay.
I'm not sure of the exact timeline, but I made my first purchase of cryptocurrency in April of 2016. And went all into Bitcoin Cash within 1 year. I can't say all in, because I've dabbled in a couple other coins, just trying out their transactions and like seeing what it takes to sync a node and that kind of thing, just out of my own curiosity. But as far as like usable cryptocurrency, all in on Bitcoin. As far as usable currency, I'm like nearly all in on Bitcoin Cash. It's pretty fantastic.
Yeah. So do you think this gives meaning to your life, like Bitcoin Cash? Like a direction or something like that? Or you have a spiritual kind of activity outside of Bitcoin Cash?
I think so, but I want it and I hope that it's temporary, because okay. I don't think that it's healthy to be like obsessed over a tool. And that's essentially what I think of Bitcoin, like the category that Bitcoin Cash belongs to. So like if I get a new screwdriver and I use screwdrivers every day, I might like go to use this thing after years of having a shitty screwdriver and being like, oh my God, I love that this like ratchets, or it has, you know, built into the bottom or something. but it's not like that's my one true calling. I want to be able to maybe convince other people to use it if they find it useful for them. But I'm also interested in, you know, other tools. So I think my main goal socially is to, even this kind of seeps into me being a software developer, I want to build tools that people find useful on their day-to-day basis. And by useful, I don't mean make their life convenient. I mean useful. Like whether or not that means that they learn more, they do more. Like those two things, I think, are more valuable to me than just it's easier to order food or watch a movie or consume.
Yeah, I know that you were like building ATMs, or you want to build ATMs.
Right. So I'm pretty sure the software is done for that, but prototyping the hardware is going to cost me a couple $1,000 that I don't have, or that I don't want to spend on a project that really doesn't seem like it has much market interest.
Okay. You were also like working in Forking Pocket.
Yeah.
I know that you were doing that.
So that was done. I have an APK somewhere. But the only thing that I did was I swapped out the Cash Fusion server. Now, I didn't have a successful fusion, but I saw that it was going through like the normal fusion status update. It just, you know, would always fail at some timing error. I don't know. I know Pocket had issues with Cash Fusion stuff before, but I think we can all forget about that, because I also got the opportunity to test out Electron Cash Mobile with Cash Fusion a week and a half ago. And It is fantastic. Like once it gets going, it's hard to get it to stop.
Yeah. So I get a vibe about you, about being like, you want to start this kind of entrepreneurial thing, right? You have said about, like, since you were a child, you wanted to create like your own business. So I think the only thing you may need is like this will to do it, no matter if you fail or you do not fail. If you win or not, it doesn't matter really. I think the good thing about starting something is that you gain confidence about yourself. So that's all you need, really. I think, like, the confidence about yourself that you started something and you are continuing doing that something. But the important thing maybe is that this something has some future, like some meaning for your life, and that's all. It's like the gasoline, the force that will drive you through hard times, because nothing is perfect. Everything you will do, you will fail. That's something that all people that start something know, right? First thing you do, you fail, you will start failing, continue failing, but you have to manage that failure or that activity so you can have success, or people see you as successful, but you are really managing all these things, these stressful like things that could happen, right? Because life is not a linear. It's like you have up downs, like a between cash price. You are up one day and you are down the other, but you continue, right? You are invincible because you believe in what you are doing. So I think that that's an important thing that everyone have to search. What gives you this plentifulness in your life, right? To start doing it and continue doing that through time.
Right, and it's not like that actually takes conscious effort either. Once, well, you know, maybe for some people that is the case, but I think for me, once I kind of click onto something, it's just this obsession where it's like, now I have to find a space for this in my day-to-day life. And on the topic of failure, it's interesting because I know that there's a lot of entrepreneurial or business types that are like, you know, use that failure to motivate you on your next goal. And that just seems kind of strange to me, because it's like, while I accept failure, it's no good. I don't like it. My coping with it is just being so stubborn-headed that I'll keep tinkering until something works. So, you know, that doesn't scale. That's why I'm constantly.
For example, you're a programmer, right? You know that right. Every programmer has to deal with these bugs that are in the code. Like,
right.
That's
the
main job of a programmer is like doing this debugging always.
Yeah.
So the people only see that the app works, but they don't know that behind that work of the app, they are debugging it constantly.
Well,
and they have been testing that app before releasing it. So that's the main part of the business, right?
Yeah, for sure. I think it's interesting, though, because, like, I think programmers, we have this weird ability where it's like, I think generally we're kind of lazy and, you know, it might be an 8-hour day, but you're only working for maybe 4 of those hours. But you're constantly thinking and trying to problem solve. Like, you might not have fingers to a keyboard, but there's something, you know, the gears are slowly grinding away at whatever the problem is.
Yeah, exactly. And that is success. So people see successful or success, but behind that is a lot of work of managing this kind of box that may surge one day or the other. So I think it's a good analogy for what an entrepreneur is, right?
Yeah, I think it's certainly, there's a couple of personality types that could be in that entrepreneurial box. But also keep in mind, if you try it and you don't think it's for you, that's completely okay too. Like, you don't, not everyone's an entrepreneur. I think maybe like 5 or 10% of the population is
exactly
personalities that fit that.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, but I think that, for example, AI will bring a lot of people out of business. Okay, people that are working, people that are working, like you said, and they are very comfortable in their comfort zone. All these, they will get out of their comfort zone by these robots, this AI that may replace them, right? So people will start We'll have to start like becoming investors, I think, or entrepreneurs. That is something that I have said in the past, right?
Yeah, I think it'll be like, you know, this is something that I see more in the conspiracy theory line of thought, but I think it'll be more of like that gig economy stuff. And I'm not a big fan of it, but I do think that's the direction that it's going to go, because most people, I don't think, have the patience or competence. And while I think AI will put people out of a job, I don't think that will lead to, you know, we just don't need more, like, okay, it's like, I think way back when, where it was like people working with crops and you know, agriculture and that kind of thing, when they made the first plow, like horse-driven plow, it wasn't like, oh my god, we have an unemployment crisis. It was, okay, we can make one person do the work of five people, that's fantastic. And then four people were unemployed all of a sudden.
Yeah.
Well, now that unemployment is a massive problem in our society, and that doesn't have to be the case. We just have to figure out, you know, the balance. There are people that are going to want to produce and want to work, and
I think that
they're
the balance,
going to do most of that anyway.
Yeah, the balance will be achieved through the natural way, I think.
Yeah.
What is the natural way of humans? How do they organize themselves naturally? Because you can create a group of 50 people of humans which go and hunt, for example, a bison. And they can organize themselves and they will search throughout the day that bison, they will hunt it and they will share it, and they will create this bonding between humans, for example. Maybe you are a vegetarian, for example. So you will need to create these agricultural activities, right, that are less natural for men. I think that agriculture is not so natural. It is like the start of the civilization as we know it today. And that's how people start organizing larger groups, right? But
yeah,
as technology evolves, these larger groups that were like a kind of possible because of agriculture and the state and all these things, they also start being like left out by technology, that every time it's getting like better and better and better. And then people will be like in a kind of communism, natural communism. So people will not do anything at all. And that's when these technocrats and all these people start talking about, for example, the metaverse, where people will actually have jobs, but in the metaverse. Because in the physical world, they are not like kind of needed, right? They,
yeah.
They, okay, so they can go to the metaverse and they can start creating their communities, their activities, and all these things that people naturally need. They need to have these activities, these organizations, this is the like bonding and all this kind of stuff, because what we are doing right now is kind of a digital thing. So we are in a kind of metaverse right now, like having these hangouts, for example. So then the technology will change the things, I think, but drastically.
Yeah, I don't understand though how people look at the metaverse and like have an optimistic perspective about this, because I think you're right in that people that are generally more liabilities than they are assets will eventually be working in digital spaces where their fuck ups won't matter. But I wonder what the point is, because I really believe that if those people just had the opportunity to be bored for a prolonged period of time, that might be encouraging. That might be the catalyst for a change of behavior. We just need to cut them off from stimuli, not give them a different form of stimuli.
So you say that stimuli is the basic thing that they need, like the stimuli. But this stimuli can be inserted like through a video game, for example. So all that matters is your mind, really.
Well, okay. To be clear, what the point I'm trying to make is, I think the issue that, you know, the people that would be considered more generally liabilities that would end up working in these digital spaces have is that they have too much stimuli. I think if they had the opportunity to be bored for months at a time, that encourages people to be a little more creative. And that creativity doesn't always necessarily mean artistic, right? They could just be interested in building boxes or like dog shelters or bird feeders or something like that. But those little things actually do more to contribute to society than just playing video games or watching TV or whatever. Going to work in these like post offices in the metaverse, that sounds like a nightmare.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it sounds like the Matrix.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. So, changing the topics, a ver, in non-KYC, how do people, changing the topic from this metaverse and all this kind of stuff, how people can do this non-KYC BCH thing as a way of life? Have you done that? Like never touching a sex, a centralized exchange, all this kind of stuff, never giving your name, because you traveled to St. Kitts, for example, and you didn't want to give your name. I know that because I see your conversations. You didn't want to give your name and all this kind of stuff because right. You are so private, right? So how can people become like this, like super private using BCH?
It's tough, I'm not gonna lie. It's certainly not an easy thing. The best tool that I have found in my arsenal has to just to be willing to socialize and network and be useful. Because unless you know a miner, someone has to touch an exchange. So, or you know, that's actually not always true. Purse.io has been fantastic, and I've earned plenty of BCH through, you know, fulfilling people's Amazon orders that way. But for the most part, it comes down to I have to know someone that's willing to put their name on the line. And I have to put my trust in those people that if there were any issues, that they wouldn't just be like, well, you know, never mind about what I was about to say, because I don't think those people know my real name either. So
so that's the central point of failure, right? In your scheme.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Okay.
And the Canadian like money system is kind of trash. So it's not like there was a certain point in time where I was using local.bitcoin.com and I was buying and selling Bitcoin Cash there because I think that that's something that is actually like a utility for people. And someone had bought some Bitcoin Cash from me and then called their bank and said that like it was a fraudulent e-transfer, which is interesting because e-transfer markets themselves as a essentially non-reversible form of money transfer. And that is not the case. I was locked out of my bank account for like 4 to 6 months, if I remember correctly. And so, you know, I was still getting paid there because I was getting paid through e-transfer, but I had to just rely on my roommates at the time, and I was paying them in Bitcoin Cash to take care of my bills and things. And it was, it's rough. It is certainly not an easy task. So the podcast helps me out that way. I get a couple Satoshis per episode.
Okay.
But aside from that, it's just like find a guy.
And then the miner, you said, like that's the source of the non-KYC BCH.
Sorry, what was that?
The miners that mine BCH is
right,
the main source of non-KYC BCH that can be traded.
Yeah. And not even necessarily BCH miners. If you know someone that uses, I don't know, there's so many Windows applications for just like, if you've got a graphics card, you can mine some random coin. And then, you know, a lot of the regular consumer that was doing that had no interest in cryptocurrency. They wanted to make a dollar, right? So I know someone that was doing that and mining, I think, Ravencoin and Grimm and a bunch of just random, whatever his program suggested he mine. And every couple of weeks he would message me up and be like, hey, I have X amount in Canadian dollars. I'd be like, I will buy it, but only if you can send it to me in Bitcoin Cash. And that worked fantastic until the market took a dump.
Yeah. And do you think that non-KYC BCH is like a more valuable that a KYC BCH, for example? So a non-KYC is more valuable than a KYC BCH. Do you think that's true?
I think my actions would say that it is, because I'm willing to pay a premium if it means I don't KYC myself. But it doesn't logically make sense to me, because I can KYC myself and then run it through Cash Fusion, and then all of a sudden, whose coins are those?
Okay. Because of Cash Fusion, it's the same price, do you think?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. Well, some people give a more, like a higher price because of non-KYC. And I think that it's correct, because it's like the source, it's a clean coin, a coin-based transaction, right?
Yeah, but this is kind of like how banks deal with credit, right? If you've got bad credit, you're better off. You have a higher chance of getting a loan than if you have no credit at all. So I wonder if exchanges will eventually have the same kind of perception, where a coin with history, even if it's some bad history, is better to them than a coin fresh from a miner, because they may not know where that actually is coming from.
Do you think that a BCH that was through Cash Fusion, people with chain analysis can know that it was transacted through Cash Fusion?
They can find out that it went through Cash Fusion, but then what?
Because they can ban like the transactions that are fused, maybe.
Good luck.
Yeah, no. Yeah, that's possible. Like they can deny to receive a BCH that was mixed or coin joined.
But I'm also really not concerned about this. This is like the Coinbase wallet delisting or getting rid of Bitcoin Cash. Like, I don't know anyone that was using the Coinbase wallet. Well, people, you know, suffer through exchanges. I think if they had the pressure put on them to stop using them forcibly, being that they were banned from, you know, dealing with Cash Fusion coins, or it was harder to withdraw, or whatever the case might be, then maybe they'd be better off for the scene than what we currently have, like FTX, where it's running off with billions of dollars and no consequences.
Yeah, if people start like creating these communities that transact BCH between them and all this, and start getting worldwide traction, and there are more and more and more commerce that are accepting it, maybe people don't have to care about if the government is okay or not with the CoinJoin, or the KYC or not KYC. This will not matter, because you are not transacting for dollars or fiat. I think the main reason that people care about this is because they have to exit the system, the blockchain, constantly, right? But in the moment that we do not need to exit the blockchain, my theory is that we really don't need to care about legal tender or about doing this the chain analysis thing and all this kind of stuff. This is actually important because we are interbreeding with that system.
Well, okay, so I think the case of legal tender is something that should be discussed, but I think in this case it's not about exchanging to fiat, because there's already ATMs, for example, on St. Kitts. It's about being able to say, I want to buy this house with Bitcoin Cash. And the contract that exists in law that says that was a, you know, legal and you know, fair trade can say that it was paid for in Bitcoin Cash. Much like, you know, you can't say that you bought a house for goats or apples, I think was the example that MP Bryson gave. And, you know, I'm not a big fan of being like the government endorses the thing that I've been obsessed over for 6 years right now, but I really think that the two arguments he made where it's about bringing dumb contracts up to speed and also having it as our best defense against CBDCs really resonated with me. So I've been running with that.
Yes, I think that this is the physical jurisdictions will always exist, right? Like you need to make business with your government every time you buy a home because you are paying taxes to them, right? Maybe it's a possibility that a community start getting this recognition, this physical recognition, and start receiving land, for example. Like it was the case of the Israeli state. They gained recognition over a piece of land because of history.
Okay.
Right? They do not have that land in the recent history. Israel was recently founded and they were given this piece of land because of their history, because of the recognition of their community. And the United Nations make it valid and legal for them. So maybe, for example, a community that gains so much worldwide traction can get this kind of land and start like stop paying tribute to these governments because these taxes are at the end a tribute, a forced tribute over a land that do not belong to them.
Okay.
So every time I have a house here in Mexico or whatever, I have to pay these taxes. I have to make business, to make this relationship with that government. So I think there we have a flaw, right? Like how we really gain this sovereignty over these people that enforce their coin. In Mexico case, for example, is the peso, or in the US, the dollar. The dollar is enforced worldwide. They tax the whole world. And with this, they fund their wars. So it is a mafia. So they are part of the problem. And we are feeding these guys.
Certainly. Right. Yeah. A question about the whole land distribution thing, though. How do you do that with a decentralized community?
First of all, I have told in other smart VCH spaces, for example, big cashers, okay, can start like creating missions at the Spanish way in the 14th century, okay? They start making these missions to the new continent, right? Big cashers can start doing these missions to St. Kitts, for example, where the government is beneficial for them, or it is in a positive relationship with our community worldwide. So we can start going them and start taking this land. gaining its political power. Yeah, people, big cashers gaining political power there, buying land, all this kind of stuff, I think can create this beneficial ecosystem for the community where libertarians, anarchists, or whatever start shifting this negative balance against the people in a positive manner. Because after all, we are the majority, right? If all big cashers start taking land in St. Kitts, relating with the politicians or teaching people to use the common coin, in this case, Bitcoin Cash, then we will start, as the founding fathers of America, start creating a real capitalism there, where people can actually profit and not only the government, like it is happening right now.
This to speaking of utopias.
Yeah, I am a dreamer.
So I think that's the end goal, but I don't think we'll end up there. I really don't. I think that people are people, and we're kind of bound to our own desire to be content. And so it'll be a long upwards battle that we won't win until shit hits the fan.
Okay, you think that shit will hit the fan?
Yeah, so that's to say, like, it will have to get worse before it gets better. And in the process of it getting worse, it will, you know, that means lives are going to be worse off, that people are going to suffer. And that's not something that I'm ever, like, you know, for. But I think that it's kind of a necessary thing to put society in a better position.
Okay, like how much worse will get until it becomes better, in your opinion? Like which can happen? It's like what can happen in your opinion?
I don't really like entertaining the idea, to be honest. But like, it depends on your circle of influencers, I guess. You know, the smaller the community that you have to put your attention to, the less that the outside chaos of the world might impact you. So, you know, it could be really bad for people that are in huge, you know, cityscapes, or like, I was in London for a day and there was like 3 million people. I am not used to that at all. That sounds like, you know, that'd be a miserable place to be if shit hits the fan, so to speak. But I think if you have like a little, you know, community of 200 people, you could make something work.
Yeah, we can organize better and more easy, and in an easier way, right?
Yeah,
if we are a small community. Strengths. Yeah. So, have you tried Cash Rain, for example, this Bitcoin Cash app that was recently released by Kim.com?
Yes. So, I think it was like 3 hours after they did the public beta. I did a Cash Rain, or no, sorry, it wasn't 3 hours. It was the morning after he announced it was public. I woke up and I saw that someone had made a Bitcoin Cash podcast discussion, and I saw Jeremy had like got it verified, someone transferred it to him or something. I don't know how that worked. But then I did a rain of, I think, $20 back when we had 60 yeah. members. Now okay. It's at like 1,700 in a day. It's wild.
I really think that this is a marketing tool. Like, for example, in Cholo Ramirez, that is this Cholo Squinkle kennel that we have
yeah.
here in Mexico City, we pay a lot of ads in Instagram, for example. We never had paid in Twitter ads because they really don't work, right? Twitter is awful right. for advertising. We also do Google Ads and all this kind of stuff, but when we do Google Ads, for example, we have to pay taxes. Like the 30% has to go for taxes, like for IVA, it is called in Mexico. So I give 100 pesos and 30 pesos are for the government in the Google Ads. So it is something awful. It is awful for advertising, but it truly works, right? When I advertise in Google. Recently, I tried this Cash Rain app and I think that it worked. I pay like 1 peso for every person, and I get for every peso one like in the tweet, for example. So in Twitter, it worked. So right. maybe we can start like paying these kind of people, so we can reach other people that are interested in Cholo Ramirez through Twitter. That I think Twitter will increase the reach and the people inside this network like a lot because of the Elon Musk effect. Maybe Twitter will be the next Facebook or the next WeChat, for example. WeChat is huge in China. It is like bigger than Facebook, than Instagram, than all these apps joined together. So maybe Twitter will be the next WeChat, I think. And with Cash Rain integrating these tweets, these promoting tweets and all this kind of stuff, I think that it is very bullish for both for Twitter and for Bitcoin Cash, I think. And personally, I will invest in this kind of promotion and pay and ad paying because I think it work.
Yeah, I'm not even so like we did one, or I shouldn't even say we in this case. Jeremy did one Cashbox tweet or Cash Rain tweet thing where it was a like and retweet scenario. But for the most part, what I've seen has just been people, you know, kind of raining on communities that they like. So, and just from that alone, because people are interested in getting kind of free money, we had like 5 or 6x increase in Twitch followers. And we also saw that with like unique viewers and unique, our unique chatters was a smaller percentage increase. But, you know, people are a lot less talkative when things are good anyway. So,
yeah, that's the first question I have. Are these people real? Are they only there for the money? Which type of person we are like attracting with this kind of app? I don't know, but Kim.com, for example, want this app to reach streamers, like Twitch streamers. I don't know if he wants to reach people, users from Twitter or whatever. Maybe he wants to people doing spaces, attract more people, all these kind of live events where people like see all day, all night, the streamer, because Twitch streamers, they really like live stream 24 hours, 9 hours, 8 hours. They are really long streams that they are making. So it is community building, I think, but what kind of people is Cash Rain attracting? That's the first question, because that's important for people paying for ads or for advertising, for all this kind of stuff. And I think it is the main attraction of Cash Rain for me. Maybe for other people, it's only cash raining, right? Like giving free money and that's all. But right. I think it is beyond that.
So 80% of people are going to be consumers, and maybe 20%, if you're lucky, are going to be creators. So that'll be the distribution Cash Rain too. You'll get 80% of people that are signing up for that platform who just want to make money, or maybe they do want to get more involved in the community and see, you know, okay, this is a hub essentially for someone's YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, Telegram, you know, XYZ community pages. I'll just be a part of it here. And then on its back end, it'll connect me to all of those things. Oh, and by doing that, I have the opportunity to make money. Why not? And then on the other side, as the creator, you're like, okay, well, I'm getting directly connected with people who, even if they're not interested, you know, the incentive is that they're incentivized, even without the content being the driving force, they're incentivized to pay some attention. So I think the numbers that we saw, they're not one-to-one, obviously, but I think they do point to it being real people. And I think the integration with other social media accounts also means that it's more likely to be real people. Like if people could just, you know, make a Cash Rain account and that's that, then that might be a little difficult. But because it's, you either have to do Twitch or a Bitcoin.com wallet, and then every additional social media account adds to your odds of getting paid out. Like, I think that's a decent enough incentive structure to minimize bots already.
Yeah, and some people are also talking about Cash ID, for example, like integrating this yeah. verification system that it is open sourced, right?
Yeah.
What is your opinion about that? Because Bitcoin.com wallet is not open source and all this stuff is like centralized. And it happens that this app is gaining traction. So a lot of transactions are being created with this app that it was released like 1-2 days ago. One day. Okay. So it is a complete success, I think. And how did you make this like open source, people said, with Cash ID? What do you think about this?
I'm fine with like, so I would be interested in Bitcoin.com while it being open source, but I also understand that as a business, you might be a little lenient to just open source the thing that makes you money. And that would, I assume, be like buying things inside of the app and having the convenience, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, sorry, I think I missed the point here.
Yeah, which is the nature of Cash ID? What is the difference between logging in with Cash ID and not doing with Cash ID? What is the difference?
I don't know the technical details to Cash ID, but I do know that it was integrated into, I think, Lazy Fox or Task. There was two different, like, Do a Task and NVCH kind of websites before. I think they might have both had Cash ID built in, but it was essentially like, and then Badger Wallet, I'm pretty sure, also had that built in, where it's essentially like you just provide a signature or an address that's connected to an identity, and then you don't need a username or password anymore because the signature proves that you control the private key, and the private key is this identity. So it doesn't seem like a real complicated idea. I'm sure it's complicated in its execution, but you know, it's not like this. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I would like to see that, but more options are more good.
Yeah. Okay, it's like logging in with your private key. That's what you say.
It's like logging in with a proof that you have the private key.
Okay, that sounds good to me. Like in the future, right? It will be much better if people sign every stuff they have with their private key, proving they are the owner of X, Y, or C account.
Yeah.
Than giving your email or whatever.
Yeah, I don't think that's like completely sufficient on stopping bots, because you could just make a bunch of wallets, like, and it's like there's no friction to creating a wallet. So, but I don't know. It's everything seems okay for now, and Cash ID is super useful for things. Yeah, for where you want an identity, it makes sense to use Cash ID.
Okay. So also, I want to know what was your experience in this BCH conference, for example. Did you see their BCH thriving economy?
Very much so. I didn't go to, you know, maybe the more local areas. There's one place where it was described to us as a more local area, and it was just called the Strip, and it was a bunch of bars, and it was on the beach, and there weren't as many places there that accepted Bitcoin Cash, but there were still a couple places that we could go, and people were receptive to it. During my entire trip there, I only had heard even of one person that was like, oh, Bitcoin, we don't do that. Everyone else was kind of like, what are you talking about? How can I learn more? Could you get me set up with something? And so, you know, I was there for 9 days, I think. And I only made a single transaction with Canadian dollars, and I didn't have to. I signed up for it so that the people that I was buying lunch for could pay me back in coins that also didn't have KYC to them.
So if you live in St. Kitts, you can do this non-KYC thing, this Anacrypt thing, easier than if you live in Canada.
Absolutely, yeah. You can get your gas. You can get your gas. You can go to a supermarket. You can pay for rooms. You can pay for a citizenship there, or like use it as proof of funds for a citizenship. I'm sure you could buy like actual, you know, six figure real estate in Bitcoin Cash there. So, yeah, absolutely, you can live there with it.
Are the native people there friendly with? With people from the outside? Are they like friendly?
I think that depends on the area. So, okay. Like I said, I didn't really go outside of the more touristy areas, but it's also kind of clear that there isn't much of a middle class there. So, you're either, you know, I think there are like labor jobs that earn on average like $4 an hour, or maybe not on average, but that towards the lower end. And that is certainly not a reasonable wage in my mind. So it, just seeing the island, like I went to a place called, I think it was Fort Brimstone. I do apologize if that's not the right name, because I've got the brochure here somewhere. Anyway, and you can see the whole island, and it's either really nice houses, really nice cars, or, and I mean, there's three massive schools there, so there's a lot of student population, nice apartment buildings. But there's also places that are just, you know, obviously kind of falling apart. A lot of rust and things that are just missing windows. So
okay, so there is a lot of poverty there, because
right.
they depend on the tourism that goes to the island, and
yeah.
The people buying these second passports.
Yes. So
yes,
I think,
right.
I think it's
like
kind of,
it's a huge deal there.
Yeah. So, but what do you do? Like, you are an island. You need an industry to kind of work in a capitalist environment. And if you don't have any like significant exports, then you need to bring people in.
Yeah, the people, the rich people in the island is actually people that get their second passports there because they were like fleeing away from their government.
Well, not entirely either. Like, I think that's probably the majority of people that I met, but there was a couple folks that I met that were, you know, from St. Kitts that were also incredibly wealthy. That's not the only... yeah, it's not just like it's only wealthy foreigners coming in.
Yeah, but there are people that are wealthy and foreigners there.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Yes. Yeah, so that's why the second passport thing was like a huge thing inside the conference and all this kind of stuff, because it is a reality. It is like the reality in that island, which
right.
It happens to have beautiful beaches, beach, right? They have a lot of beaches. blue ocean, all this kind of stuff that the Caribbean
yeah.
offers to people.
I've never seen water so blue in my entire life.
Yeah, we in Mexico, we have a lot of that, like in the Caribbean. But there, yeah. I was surprised that there have beautiful beaches. So that's a good thing.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite memories of that whole trip was going to a place called Reggae Beach. And there was a cat, I assume it was just a stray, but it was just hanging around like as a beach bum. And it was like the happiest looking cat I've ever seen in my entire life. Just loving the
was
sun.
Was it cheap lighting? Wasn't it cheap lighting? We have a cat in the community.
No, this was a blonde kitty.
Okay,
if I blonde. Saw cheap lightning.
Yeah. So... This was a very nice conversation with you, Jet. I don't know if anyone else here want to talk with Jet about something that you may want to ask him or whatever. If you want, I have invited everyone here, I think. We have been here for an hour. So thank you very much, Jet, for being with us and talking to the audience here about your views, about how you see BCH. I think you're a spiritual man also. That's my impression. You're a very spiritual man, I think. I may be wrong, but that's my impression.
It's weird. The more I talk to people, I think I get the impression that that's the impression that other people get, but I don't really feel particularly spiritual.
Okay, that's good to know. Well, thank you very much, Jet. And every Cholos army here that come, or maybe they only hear it in their computers, send the proof of you assisting the Smart BCH Twitter Hangout, and I will reward everyone with a Cholos army NFT, also the speaker here. And,
no,
and
cool.
Thank you very much. Yeah. So you can trade this NFT also. You don't have to keep it. You can trade it. Okay. And this will start creating this like kind of market, maybe. You can also be rewarded with the Cholos Army NFT. Every time you tweet about Cholos Army in Twitter, if you have your profile picture with a Cholos Army NFT and you tweet about Cholos Army hashtag, you are rewarded every time. Okay, so thank you very much and bye bye.
Thank you.